Hello and welcome back to Death and Taxes, a private wealth podcast from Burgess Salmon. I'm Tim Williams, and on today's podcast, we're going to talk about natural capital and what that means in the world of private wealth. And so I'm delighted to be joined today by my colleagues, Kevin Kennedy.
Hello.
And Ross Simpson.
Hi, great to be here.
And we are going to talk you through what you need to know about natural capital and the green agenda. So to start with, I thought it'd be really helpful to talk through some of the sort of high level bits, clear up some of the jargon before we dive into the meat of what we're seeing in the market. So I think, Kevin, if we can start with you, please, it would be really helpful if you could just set out for us what we mean by natural capital.
Okay, thanks, Tim. Well, like with everything, there's multiple definitions around this. Looking at this, the one we're about to use is probably the best one. It comes from the UK Natural Capital Committee, who are very highly regarded nationally and internationally. And they are essentially the elements of nature that directly and indirectly produced value or benefits to people. So it's this idea of kind of putting an economic value of some type on natural benefits. So benefits produced by ecosystems, water, land, minerals. You've got some really obvious ones, like clean water is better than dirty water. You've got other far more subjective ones, well-being from nature. That's often quite controversial. And then you've got some issues where you've got trade-offs. So for example, planting trees, locking up carbon rather than growing food. They all fall within this kind of natural capital umbrella.
Thanks, Kevin. That's really helpful to set the scene for this discussion. But as we go through the podcast, you're going to hear lots of acronyms and bits of jargon that I think it would be helpful if we could have a little bit of a glossary of to start with. So, Ross, I'm going to go to you first. BNG is something we hear a lot about. What exactly do we mean by BNG?
Oh, thanks, Tim. Yeah, biodiversity net gain. Essentially, it's something that's born out of the Environment Act. It's this idea that when it comes to development, we need to be looking at a baseline of biodiversity and creating a 10% uplift in biodiversity improvement.
And that's in the context of development land often, isn't it? So if I'm covering some countryside with a housing development, I'm covering in concrete, I take the baseline of what that landscape had in terms of biodiversity, and I try and improve it by 10% somewhere else effectively. It's sort of taking the what you've taken out by building something on an area of land, you need to put back somewhere else and then have that uplift. That's your net gain.
Exactly right. And there's a whole, you know, regime around it. How do you achieve it and where do you achieve it? And you know, when there is development taking place, this idea that it, you know, should be as proximate to the site of development as possible. And there's kind of mitigation hierarchy, if you like, in terms of getting it as on site as possible. And only if that's not possible that you would look further afield to maybe some off-site locations.
Okay, so that's BNG. So another three-letter acronym is ELMS, ELMS, four-letter acronym even, sorry. So, Kevin, could you just say what we mean by ELMS?
This is one of the government policies. Here's another acronym for you, coming out from DEFRA, Department for the Environment, Food and Rural Affairs. ELMS stands for Environmental Land Management Scheme, also sometimes called Environmental Land Management Systems. And it kind of is what it says on the tin. It's a form of subsidy, which is aimed at achieving environmental benefits from the land. And in context, it is the replacement for a previous blizzard of acronyms, which were the government's way of subsidising farmers to produce food. So the switch, the kind of philosophical switch, has been moving away from that into paying public money for public goods, for things that should enhance our environment.
And that was a sort of policy shift under Michael Gove, wasn't it? It sort of began a little while ago, but is now biting as the previous subsidy regime is withdrawn. And we landowners need to enter these schemes to replace the funding that they've effectively lost from DEFRA through the basic payment scheme. Okay, so those are two nasty acronyms, but what about the words that we might think we know what they mean, but in a bit in a context of natural capital, they might mean slightly different things. So carbon is a big thing that we talk about in the context of natural capital. I'm going to throw that out to the floor. Who wants to talk about carbon?
Carbon, yeah, happy to take that one, Tim. There's lots of ways that we are looking to engage with carbon in natural capital markets. Essentially, we are there's a lot of what we're seeing and the kind of schemes that we see is about sequestering carbon, trying to lock it in. Maybe we will, you will find a corporate, for example, who has gone through the mitigation hierarchy of avoiding as much carbon as it can, reducing that which it can't avoid, but will be left with a certain amount of carbon left over that it needs to offset. And then we are seeing these projects where carbon, where corporates are looking to landowners and other kind of land management arrangements, where they're locking in carbon and offsetting type arrangements. And that can be achieved through various different types of project. We've been seeing a range of tree planting, peatland restoration, and even blue carbon projects as well, involving the marine environment. So yeah, that's a flavour of what we're seeing in carbon.
Fantastic. Thank you, Ross. And the last one I think we probably really need to talk about is nutrient neutrality, which is something that's sort of been here and there and now is back again, I think, Kevin. So what's nutrient neutrality when we talk about it?
So that's the principle, much like biodiversity net gain, but you're dealing with particular issues that are affecting river catchment areas. So it applies in particular areas where there's water catchment. And it's if there is development granted, it's to prevent the incursion of additional nutrients into watercourses. And so you've got a particular small-scale regime, but one that's quite dramatic because it generally involves handing over control of land for 120 years. So it's something which has been in operation for a couple of years, and it had an effect of stymieing a lot of developments. Now that's been dealt with to a degree, but it's one of the things that people have some experience of if they're within that catchment.
Okay, that's really helpful to have a sort of bit of a glossary before we start diving into the detail. But I suppose taking it at a very basic level, all of these things we're talking about are changes to land management in one way or another, looking at, you know, doing things to improve environmental health, I guess. And one common theme from a lot of those is around monetization, effectively, isn't it? This is kind of being paid for doing things and doing different things. And some of those things that we mentioned are government funded. So ELMS, as you said, Kevin, is a government scheme. BNG, Biodiversity Net Gain, is not. That's a planning requirement, but the money for it effectively comes from private industry. Developers have to fund those projects themselves. And carbon can be government backed, but it's essentially a private market thing, I suppose. Mm. But I suppose the commonality there is this is all things landowners can do to generate a return. Now, I suppose it's worth saying that actually there's lots of people out there who are doing this for different reasons. I mean, conservation has always been a big part of landowners in the UK's mindset. It's very important to lots of them. So there are lots of people who are doing all this stuff anyway because they want to. But I suppose the distinction now is that they can do it. Some landowners are doing it to get paid effectively, and which is of benefit to them, but also of wider benefit to the environment as a whole.
Yeah, that's exactly right, Tim. And certainly some of our landowners and farming clients are seeing this as a potential opportunity to create new income streams and diversify their businesses. And there is a range of options out there for them to do that and to participate in these markets, whether directly themselves or in partnership with specialist bodies or through brokerage type arrangements. And there are trading platforms out there too. And, you know, they will be underpinned by things like the Woodland Carbon Code, the Peatland Carbon Code, other types of arrangements which are in place for these voluntary type markets.
And it's probably also worth adding to what you said, Tim, that a lot of this at the moment is government driven, but there's a very real sense that that is intended to be pump priming, and that a lot of the money that is going into green investments globally will be put into these sorts of investments in land. And obviously for those of us in this area who've been talking about it, conversation has been absolutely dominated for the last 18 months, 2 years by BNG, biodiversity net gain. But probably the big one is carbon and carbon sequestration and how that can be dealt with in a long-term approach. So we'll probably be hearing far more about carbon and private money going into carbon schemes on UK land.
So we've heard a little bit about the high-level theory of all of this, and it all sounds very interesting and lots of opportunities for landowners. But what are we actually seeing people doing?
Well, it's been remarkable, Tim, in that we were talking about this stuff 5 years ago in a real theoretical sense, and it's actually started happening in real life. So what we're seeing with the implementation of compulsory BNG, that's driven a lot of people to start taking actions and to have to contemplate actions now in what is still, in reality, quite an immature market. So what we've been seeing in practice is that from the supply side, the people who are putting their land into these schemes, at the moment in the private sector, there's a lot of caution about this because there's been the regulations have been a long time coming and it's been quite stop-start. So there is quite a bit of scepticism still as to whether there is a valid market there. But on the other side, we're seeing the landowning institutions, who are a major part of this land sector in the UK, they have been taking a lead. And that's driven by a number of factors, including the fact that most of them will have clear stakeholder engagement or ESG pressure upon them, or simply will have enough land and enough marginal land that maybe isn't that good previously for food production, that they're thinking, can we put this to some other use? So in practice, what we're seeing is a lot of those bodies getting to grips with what they have and what they can do with it and how they can actually make this work and taking it out of the kind of discussion cloud and putting it down into something concrete, if you will excuse the pun.
And is that sort of adoption by these bigger institutional landowners having a wider impact? Do you think it's being felt elsewhere in the market, Ross?
Absolutely. And it's almost generated this kind of new class of buyer that just didn't exist, 5-10 years ago as well. We've been acting for a number of entities who are investing and buying large scale rural land holdings, all with the intent on protection, restoration of nature, natural processes, the delivery of ecosystem services. Depending on where they are in the market and what the drivers are and who is behind these organizations, a range of motivation behind them as well, somewhere economic return isn't necessarily driving at all. It is something that they're looking to generate, but it's not the purpose of what they do, maybe just but a natural consequence of what they're doing. Others will be more driven to monetize, it's interesting the impact of just seeing that new class of buyer out there and acting for those types of buyer too, and what that has done to the market as well. It's a much more crowded market in terms of who is interested in land and buying land.
And it comes back to a point that you made, Kevin, around sort of marginal land maybe having its day now. There's a sort of shift, isn't there, where rural land goes from just being how much food can you grow on it, or how nice does it look, perhaps, in the market terms, to something else. And do you think that's shifting the way that landowners across the board are viewing their portfolios?
I think that's right. And one of the great surprises is that land which might typically be thought as being not very good turns out to be massively valuable from a biodiversity point of view. So it really does change your approach to it. For example, if you've got boggy, waterlogged land, fantastic. It's really valuable and special from that point of view. Or an old bit of hard sanding covered in gravel that no one's done anything with for 30 or 40 years. We're seeing some of those when they're actually measured by ecologists having massive biodiversity values. Really is quite interesting as to what you think will have a high value and what in reality has a high value. So yeah, it is making people reassess what they own and what it can and should be used for.
So if I'm a landowner wanting to get involved in some of these projects, what are the issues I need to consider? So let's say I've got some land that might be suitable for a BNG project. Kevin, what do I need to have in mind as I look at that project as a possible use of my land?
Well, let's assume you are a landowner and you're approached by someone who wants to use your land for BNG. So they're offsetting from a development they have presumably nearby, maybe not. What you have to consider is that you will be entering into some form of binding agreement, which is going to mean that you will need to deliver these outputs from your land. And what you may find is that you're made quite an attractive offer to do that, but that's going to have a lifetime of a minimum of 30 years.
Mm.
And that is actually quite a big deal. And what we've heard some anecdotal reports of, and it's been picked up a bit, it's had a bit of traction, this, that there's a lot of trees that are not surviving past year one or year two, because they're being planted and they're just not being looked after enough. They're not being watered enough.
Mm.
So that there are some consequences to that. It's not necessarily easy. It kind of has to fit in. It's either got to be your main play, because that's what you want to do, or fit in with your plans. So you know you're on this.
Yeah, you're binding the land for significant periods of time here. This is largely multi-generational decisions that are being made, you know, putting land into this kind of project or scheme. I think the other thing that is, you know, going right back to the start, making any sort of decision about participating in a project, data is everything when it comes to understanding what you've got. And what types of project you might want to participate and get involved in. I think it's really important that from the outset, if you're looking at an opportunity, you do undertake a fairly robust, comprehensive baseline assessment to establish what are the opportunities, what can you achieve,
and at what risk as well. I think that's the other side, isn't it? You know, because we talk to lots of different sorts of landowner, don't we? So, you know, there are different concerns for people who are farming in hand, say, versus people who've got tenants. And maybe we can talk a little bit about landlord and tenant relations a bit later on. Particular issues for trustees. And we've talked a lot about the way trustees need to approach these decisions. And your point, Ross, about it being a very long-term arrangement on the land. How does this impact on the next generation? How does it impact on future value, future use? And, you know, who is in favour, who might be against this? Because actually, at the moment, certainly as we've talked about, the returns might not be as certain as they are from, you know, business as usual. But then again, farming's pretty risky as well, always has been, but with the changing climates, farms that have previously been very good at doing one thing may find that more challenging. So maybe these investments, you know, are no less risky than continuing what we might have previously thought of as business as usual. So BNG is relatively novel, but we've been talking about carbon credits for years now, haven't we? Is the carbon that we're talking about in this context the same thing, or are we talking about a new market that's developing?
That's a really good question, Tim. I think we're going to see both, actually, because carbon credits, the idea of locking up carbon, has been with us for a long time through trees and the Woodland Carbon Code. That's been really helpful. And Ross, you've seen quite a bit of that in practice.
Oh, for sure, absolutely. We've been really quite busy in terms of helping with these kind of tree planting agreements and the kind of carbon credit arrangements that sit alongside them. They've definitely been around for a while, something that we're involved in, you know, the early days of these kinds of projects. I think the Woodland Carbon Code has been around now for a while, and it's given that underpinning. It's just brought integrity to the market and a confidence that there is there's something tradable that is validated, it's verified, and it's something that can be pointed to. And that's definitely really it's a growing rapidly area.
And so presumably, well, some of these things that we've talked about are government backed. Government is presumably looking to a sort of high integrity private market to really support this stuff and really make it take off
Well, that's it.
across the UK.
At this point in time, it is just a private voluntary market at the moment, but it is doing it, you know, in a high integrity way. We should all have an interest in making sure that we're creating as high integrity natural capital market as possible, and that's what the Woodland Carbon Code and the Peatland Carbon Code and other codes that will emerge will do and help to achieve.
Yes, and we hear that the Soil Carbon Code as such is on its way, or there'll be a British standard which will help regulate soil carbon codes so that locking up carbon will be spreading to more lowland areas as well and won't just be woodland and peatland, but it'll apply more across the board.
So it's fair to say that at the moment there's a sort of there's lots of opportunities out there, but those are only going to grow as time comes on, goes on. And as you say, Kevin, there's, you know, it's horses for courses as ever, isn't it? So there's going to be different land owners with different sites who are going to be able to take advantage of different things and enter into different schemes. Some of those may be possible now, but some of them might not be quite there yet, because as you say, Ross, it is all backed up by this idea of having a good quality market to sell into, and probably for some landowners a better understanding of how these schemes play out over the longer term.
Yes, and that longer term point is certainly when we're speaking to landowners, that's the thing that concerns them, the level of clarity as to how long their land is going to be subject to particular obligations. And there is some uncertainty, it's fair to say, about that. You have, coming out of the BNG exercise, you know, a 30-year minimum term for a scheme, but there are many people have been asking questions about what happens afterwards, and does that mean I've changed the nature of my land permanently or what? And you contrast that with a nutrient neutrality scheme, which is 120 years, where you conceptually you kind of understand, right, I've put that away, and that's grandchildren or great-grandchildren sort of time.
And one of the concerns for landowners that we speak to is around the tax treatment. And I think there was a consultation last year about this very topic of, you know, how are these kind of schemes and arrangements going to be taxed for landowners? Because as I said earlier on, this is all about changing land use. If you're farming, we kind of know how that works for tax purposes. You probably get agricultural property relief, provided you meet the criteria, and you might get business property relief as well. And for lots of landowners, that's hugely valuable because it's a relief from inheritance tax, and what they rely on for their estate planning. But there are also income tax issues and capital taxes issues that flow from these schemes as well, because obviously they make money, you get money in, you have to pay some sort of tax on it. But equally, what kind of reliefs can you claim on that income and capital disposals as well? So lots of uncertainty there, some of which was resolved in the March budget. So confirmation that agricultural property relief from inheritance tax will be available for the ELMs schemes. So think back to Kevin's glossary about what ELMs were. But also for some carbon markets. Now, there's a bit of a tension here, and this comes back to what we were saying about the sort of integrity of these markets. Government-supported carbon markets will be recognised for APR, so Woodland Carbon Code, Peatland Carbon Code, tick. But actually, at the moment, it's not quite as widespread. So if you're going into the private market schemes, which, as we said, government is probably going to look to be the real driver for all of this, there's a bit of uncertainty there about your APR treatment. So that was sort of partly good news from the budget. For business property relief, expected but possibly less good news, in that we have to go back to first principles. We have to look at what the activities on the land actually are, and whether or not they constitute a trade or a non-investment activity for business property relief purposes. So lots of this is, again, comes back to the uncertainty of what this looks like over the long term, because with lots of these schemes, there might be lots of activity up front, probably a good argument that that's all trading. But at the end, you might end up with deliberately not having to do very much on your land. So query whether that is a trade. So a little bit of uncertainty still about BPR, but hopefully as time goes on, that will become clearer. There is a group of industry bodies who are going to come together to look at the income tax and more business tax side of that. So hopefully there'll be some more clarity on that going forward. So we talked about the benefit for landowners, but clearly lots of land is not just occupied by the person who owns it. Kevin, how do tenants come into this whole field? Excuse the pun.
Indeed. Well, because we are talking about essentially rural land almost exclusively, a lot of that is tenanted. And this has been a big issue between landlords and tenants at different levels. Who gets the benefit? Who's carrying out the work? Who can get onto the land? All that sort of thing. To give some context to it, very recently we've had published for England the Agricultural Landlord and Tenant Code of Practice for England. And that addressed this head on. And so this was produced by a government endorsed group, which brought together tenants representatives and landlords representatives. So it's quite sector wide. And its general approach was a blanket bans, for example, on participation in environmental schemes were discouraged. And where landlord's consent was to be needed for many of these schemes, which they are because they're long term, that should be provided in good time, and tenants should be respecting landlords' interests and vice versa. It's very much from the perspective of trying to encourage cooperation between landlords and tenants, which also envisages inherently sharing the obligations and sharing the benefits. And that's quite an important thing that we'll see referenced over the next few years in terms of where the mindset should be.
So thank you both so much for such an interesting discussion. I mean, I hope that's been useful for everybody. Before we go though, before I let you off into the rest of your days, I want you to give me a key takeaway each, please. Starting with you, Ross.
My key takeaway is that this is a really exciting area. There are opportunities here for existing land and estate owners, for others to get involved. It's an important opportunity, certainly for the existing land and estate owners to diversify. The rate of market development that we are seeing is that, you know, this is a space which is growing rapidly. Don't be left behind. Get involved and engage with it.
Great stuff. Thank you, Ross. And Kevin, what about you?
Well, it all sounds a bit Pollyanna-ish from us, really, because I agree to a great extent with everything Ross says. This is a real thing. And in a way, most exciting for me is this gives any landowner the opportunity to think about their land in a really holistic and different way, and think about what benefits there are from that land, how they can use it, what the long-term future is, which is really good.
Many thanks to Ross and Kevin, and thank you again for listening to this episode of Death and Taxes, the Private Wealth podcast from Burgess Salmon. You can listen to our previous episodes and get in touch with the team at burgess-salmon.com or on our LinkedIn page. Don't forget to subscribe to stay up to date with our latest podcasts.